Their top stories: at least 19 people are killed, many wounded, in a suicide attack on an education center in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Hurricane Ian leaves a massive trail of destruction across the U.S. state of Florida, killing at least 19 people. And Brazil's opposition presidential candidate, Lula da Silva, widens his lead over incumbent Jair Bolsonaro 2 days ahead of the country's presidential election. Hello everyone and a very warm welcome. Now our top story: a deadly suicide attack at an educational center in Afghanistan has left at least 19 people dead. Blast happened at the Dasht-e-Barchi neighborhood of western Kabul. It took place as students were preparing for an exam. Police say attack has also left over two dozen others injured. Most of the casualties are young girls. No group has yet claimed responsibility. Afghanistan's Interior Ministry has slammed the attack, saying those who target civilians prove their inhuman cruelty and lack of moral standards. And our correspondent in Kabul, Rahmatullah Baghban, joined us earlier with more details on this attack.
A local source who was also an eyewitness of the explosion told me that the suicide attacker first approached the gate of the educational center and shot the security guards. Then he entered the classroom. That was a classroom of girls, and opened fire on the girls, then detonated his explosives and blow up the classroom. Most of the casualties are girls. People here in Kabul are rushing to the hospitals to donate blood for the victims or for the injured people that are received by the hospitals. Only Muhammad Ali Jinnah Hospital in the neighborhood has received 10 dead and more than 15 injured. Other victims are taken to other hospitals. Local sources say that the figure or the number of casualties are higher than what is announced by the Kabul police spokesman. And that is likely to rise because most people or the injured people are in very critical conditions.
And now Hurricane Ian in the U.S. has become powerful again in the Atlantic after it showed little signs of weakening. Ian has intensified into a Category 1 storm. It has generated winds surpassing the speed of 135 kilometers per hour. Hurricane is now churning through the South Carolina coast after pummeling Florida. But the devastation still remains in southern U.S. state, and residential communities are completely inundated. Rescue efforts are underway to help stranded people. According to U.S. media, at least 19 people have been killed. Millions of residents across the vast parts of Florida are also grappling with power outages. Ian is said to be one of the most devastating hurricanes in U.S. history. United States midterm elections are less than 6 weeks away, with Republicans expected to retake control of the House. Rami Mazahiri has more on the story from the United States.
Polls show that a divided Congress appears all but assured 6 weeks before the federal legislative vote in the United States, which would also ensure continued political division and stagnation. The Democrat-led inquiry over protests which alleged election fraud in 2020 continue to plod on, but polls show they have had essentially no effect on changing voters' opinions. While longtime Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi looks certain to be forced out of power in November, the top level of Republican leadership looks likely to add more so-called Trumpists, reflecting the enduring influence of ex-President Donald Trump.
To go Democrat, Democrats pulled both of the Senate and the House. I think we're in for really rough times if they don't. Divided government with the most of the Republicans that are running is not going to be a good thing. It's not good to have a bunch of election deniers in a democracy.
The biggest unofficial political party in the United States is actually the self-declared independent voter. Polls indicate that a huge swing of 12% has taken place within this king-making group. In 2020, post-election polls found that they favored Democrats by 7%, but independents are now tilting towards Republicans by 5%.
Not happy with the way things are, obviously. We're all worried about inflation, and it's impacting our, you know, wallets. I wish there were more parties besides Republicans and Democrats, because it's just, you know, party interests, and people like you and me are just left behind. We have to live our lives, and politicians aren't really thinking about us.
Pollsters say the Democratic Party seems certain to lose control of the lower house of parliament, if not both houses. As the election nears, many expect the ongoing inflation and economic growth disasters caused by blowback from Western sanctions on Russia to play a larger and larger role in voters' decisions. A recent survey by Forbes found that 30% of Americans are drawing from their savings more than usual, which is the highest percentage in the survey's history. Another analysis found that the average American has lost over $4,000 in income since Joe Biden took office due to the increases in the inflation and interest rates. The midterms are on track to be the most expensive vote ever, reaching $10 billion by Election Day. Many say that's a reminder of the enormous role played in American democracy by money and advertising. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
And now, Welcome Up News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's crimes against Palestinian children reflects the regime's sadistic policies against civilians. Hamas emphasized Israel's crimes against Palestinian children, people, land, and sanctities will not make the regime secure, but only strengthen the resistance. It also has called on the international rights organizations to take serious action to blacklist Israeli leaders over child killing. Movement was reacting to the death of 7-year-old Rian Suleiman, who died of a heart attack after being chased by regime forces. The United States has called for a thorough and immediate investigation into the circumstances surrounding the child's death. Our correspondent in Ramallah, that is Mona Kandil, says Israeli soldiers attacked the village to arrest Palestinians, and they're even seeking to arrest school children.
Of course, it's a very sad and heartbreaking 7-year-old Palestinian. A child, Rayan Suleiman, from the village of Taqwa, was returning back home from his school, and Israeli soldiers had already raided the village of Taqwa, claiming that they want to arrest Palestinians and even students, school students, whom the Israeli soldiers accused them for throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles. According to the father of Rayan Suleiman, the Israeli soldiers were chasing the children returning back from school. And then some soldiers had already raided the house while they carry out searches and inspections. They raided the house of little Suleiman. And they were a little bit, let's say, investigating his father or something like that. Israeli military claim that they didn't even raid Taqwa at that time. Other stories are saying that it's true. Israeli troops raided Taqwa, but one of the Israeli officers were speaking calmly to the father of little Suleiman, and they were not chasing any Palestinian children.
And now joining us for the program is Wafa Aloudaini, Palestinian activist and journalist, joining us from Gaza City, and Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joining us from Belfast. Gentlemen, Fra Hughes and Ms. Aloudaini, welcome to the program, the both of you. Ms. Aloudaini, we're going to start with you. You are in Gaza City. You get firsthand accounts, and we remember what happened at the so-called buffer zone wall just a couple years ago, where so many children, journalists, paramedics, protesters, along with a man in a wheelchair, if you remember, were all taken down, killed, murdered by regime snipers. Tell us about what takes place, Wafa, in your neck of the woods on a daily basis and gets very little coverage from Western governments and Western media.
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. And indeed, this is not a new policy and new act from the occupation forces. Indeed, what is happening here in Palestine, it is severe occupation and it is severe genocide and ethnic cleansing are being practiced by the occupation, the Israeli occupation. You know, like, I mean, like the international community that just see everything here and they witness everything here, but they turn like a blind eye to the oppressed people of Palestine. You know, like in the occupied West Bank, actually, let me just go back to the U.S. President visit to the Palestinian territories. Actually, it was like a blessing and a green line for the occupation forces in order to keep oppressing the Palestinians and seizing more Palestinian lands. So you can see the violent nightly raids, the detaining people, the detaining of Palestinian people, the demolishing of houses, the murdering of the Palestinians. Like daily you can hear a news of a Palestinian being killed by the occupation police. And you can see more aggressive acts by the occupation. And indeed, all of these aggressive acts become like a daily basis, whether in the occupied West Bank or East Jerusalem or even here in Gaza. But they practice oppression and they practice degradation, but they just in a different way. The last victim, as your correspondent said, is the seven-year-old Rayan. He reminds me exactly of what happened with my little brother. He was only 2 years old. During the first intifada, actually, this happened. He was only 2 years old. He went with my sister to buy milk, you know, for our family. So they faced the occupation forces outside in the street. And then they quickly ran home while being chased by the well-armed or the armed-to-teeth Israeli occupation forces. Then my little brother fell on the ground, on a rock indeed, and hit his head, and this thing caused him a permanent mental handicap. And later on, after a few years, he died due to this thing. So I can tell you, like also during our covering, our coverage in the Great Return March, like I witnessed by myself, I saw by myself that the occupation snipers, they just snipe the children, they just snipe the youth, and they know exactly where their bullets went. So according to the Israeli soldiers, they said that they know where their bullets goes. So so they snipe the children, they snipe the people who really were defenseless. They were unarmed indeed, but they targeted them and they killed them. So you can see that this is not a new thing for the occupation. This is, they just practice this brutality and this discrimination and oppression against all Palestinians, not only in the West Bank or Gaza or Jerusalem, like throughout Palestine, you can see such aggressive acts by the occupation forces.
Thank you, Awafa. And Fra, thanks for being patient and welcome to the program. Fra, children are being killed on a whole scale level, both in occupied territories, in Gaza, in Yemen. You know, these are two places where you hear nothing from the Western governments as far as true condemnations. They always ask for investigations to be carried out, but you don't see anything with teeth. No sanctions, no real repercussions. Why?
Well, firstly, I'd like to offer my sympathy to the family and relatives of that young boy, Soleimani, and indeed my fellow guests. I'm very sorry to hear what happened to your younger brother, but it's a perfect example of an apartheid rogue regime that has a culture that has no interest and no historical vestige of being in the region, and therefore cannot accommodate the countries and the cultures and the languages and the religions of the people that are their neighbors. I think what we're looking at here is, every time I think of what's happening in Palestine, I always think of the native Indians in the American continent. We had white European settlers and colonists, just like we have in Israel. These people who have come from different countries, who were not born in the region, have gone over with the sole intent of continuing to steal the land, steal the water resources, steal the very dreams and hopes from the Palestinian people of an independent and sovereign future from them. The Israelis intend to steal every bit of land that they can in Palestine, and they can only do that by the continuation of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. The reason that we in the West see very, very, very little of what is happening is because the mainstream media won't cover it, because it is against the foreign policies of America, the EU, and countries like Britain, who have helped create, sustain, finance, arm Israel, and continue to use it as a bulwark against the unity not only of the Palestinian people, but the unity of the Arab and Persian people of the region, who should come together in order to defy the will of the imperialist West and the expansionist policies of Israel. And I think it's really, really, really important to understand that they murder children as a form of collective punishment. When they kill a child, they're not just killing the child, they're killing the family, the child's friends. They're inducing fear and oppression and the reality of living under brutal occupation. Anyone who picks up a pen, picks up a stone, picks up a rifle, picks up a rock is a target for the Zionist regime. They will not allow any form of resistance whatsoever against their designs in Palestine. And I think what is most important is like people like me who see the call for justice and dignity in Palestine as a call to humanity. We must stand beside the Palestinian people who, under international law, have the right to resist illegal military occupation by any means necessary. So the people who resist the Israeli occupation are just like the French resistance from the Second World War.
All right, thank you both for joining us on the program. Wafa Aludani there joining us from Gaza City, and Fra Hughes joining us out of Belfast. And viewers, that brings us to the conclusion of the News Review program. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Since the U.S. occupation forces in eastern Syria, especially in the oil fields of the country, news sources have published numerous reports about the smuggling of Syrian oil and Syrian grain into neighboring Iraq by the U.S. military. Smuggling of Syrian grain and oil takes place while the government and people of Syria are suffering from a lack of fuel, and cars sometimes wait in long lines for fueling at petrol pumps. The Syrian government considers the presence of American military forces in the northeast of the country and southeast of the country as illegal and an occupation of its sovereign territory. Meanwhile, numerous reports and regional officials have pointed to America's role in transferring Daesh terrorists throughout the region and even airlifting supplies to the terrorist group. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Cradle website writes, U.S. occupation forces on 25th of September smuggled 79 tankers loaded with Syrian oil from the fields of Jazeera region to Iraq. U.S. forces, which have taken control of essential oil and gas fields in Hasaka and Deir ez-Zor governorates in Syria with the help of Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, regularly smuggle fuel and grain out of the country. The looted oil was moved through the illegal Al-Mahmoudiya border crossing into neighboring Iraq, where U.S. occupation forces are also stationed. Damascus considers the oil theft campaign part of a larger violation by U.S. of international law, as the plundering of the nation's natural resources worsens an already dire hunger crisis in Syria. In the meantime, the economy in the war-torn country is in a state of disaster, as the bloody conflict has destroyed decades of progress, leaving what once was the Arab world's most industrialized nation with severe shortages of food and energy. In collaboration with so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, the U.S. Army is taking advantage of the devastation in the country to steal its resources, while at the same time imposing strict sanctions that prevent Damascus from securing much-needed resources from abroad. According to the Syrian Ministry of Oil and Mineral Resources, the U.S. has looted an average of 66,000 barrels of oil every day in the first half of 2022, or over 83% of the country's daily output. In contrast, domestic oil refineries receive nearly 14,200 barrels a day. Syria's official Sana'a news agency, citing local sources in Al-Yarubiya town, reported that a convoy of 60 tankers left Syria through the illegal Mahmoudiya border crossing on Tuesday, 21st of September, and headed towards Iraqi territories. The development comes nearly a fortnight after the United States smuggled a batch of stolen Syrian oil into neighboring Iraq. Syria's Sana'a news agency cited local sources from Yarubiya town as saying on 9th of September, a convoy of U.S. occupation forces consisting of 88 tankers loaded with stolen Syrian oil left from the illegitimate Mahmoudiya crossing and entered Iraqi territory. The U.S. military has stationed forces and equipment in northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. However, Damascus maintains the deployment is meant to plunder the country's rich mineral resources, including oil. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on more than one occasion that U.S. military forces were in Syria mainly for its oil. Syrian officials say Washington's continued presence in the country is aimed at preventing Damascus from regaining control over oil, natural gas, and food resources in the northeastern regions of the country, which once allowed Syria to enjoy modest self-sufficiency in energy and in foodstuffs. Washington and its allies have also imposed crushing sanctions on Damascus and threatened nations that do business with Damascus with secondary sanctions. These sanctions have further limited Syria's access to resources needed to rebuild the country from the devastating foreign-backed conflict which began in 2011 and have prevented the country from importing medicines and much-needed medical equipment. The anti-war website covers the same story, but from a different angle. On Monday, 26th of September, Syria's foreign minister addressed the UN General Assembly in New York and called on US to end its military occupation of eastern Syria. The US currently has about 900 troops stationed in eastern Syria and backs Kurdish forces in the region. This illegal presence allows the US to control about one-third of Syria's territory, an area where most of the country's oil and wheat resources are located. Officially, the US maintains that its presence in the country is about fighting Daesh terrorists, but the Syrian government rejects this notion. Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad said at a UN headquarters in New York, he said, "Fighting terrorism does not happen through an illegitimate international coalition that violates Syria's sovereignty and destroys towns and villages in Syria." On top of the occupation, the US also maintains crippling economic sanctions on Syria. US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has previously said that these sanctions are meant to prevent Syria's reconstruction until there is a political settlement in Syria, meaning regime change in Damascus. The Syrian Foreign Minister, Faisal Miqdad, discussed the sanctions on Syria, saying the country has been economically besieged by Western powers. He said, "The war against Syria ultimately was an attempt by the West to maintain control over the world. The situation in eastern Syria highlights the hypocrisy of the United States, as President Biden's address to the UN General Assembly focused on accusing Russia of violating the United Nations Charter by taking Ukrainian territory." The top Syrian diplomat, Faisal Miqdad, also said, "Countering terrorism does not mean occupying other people's land, establishing a safe zone, or backing terrorists." Referring to the regime's multiple assaults so far against international airports in the Syrian capital and the western Syrian city of Aleppo, Faisal Miqdad said, "Damascus maintains that the occupying regime backs Daesh terrorists as well as al-Nusra Front terrorists, which is al-Qaeda's offshoot in Syria, and carries out attacks against civilian airports in Syria." Elsewhere in his remarks, the Syrian foreign minister said, "Foreign presence and violations that have been carried out by Washington and its allies against Syria have caused the country to incur material damage running to $107 billion.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The war between Russia and Ukraine is now in its ninth month, while people in four Ukrainian regions have started voting in referendums on joining Russia. Kiev claims to have expanded its territorial gains in the east. Moscow is now saying the West has become part of the war by supplying military aid and information to Kiev and is accusing the West of nuclear blackmail. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll discuss the latest developments of the conflict and the West's role in the prolongation of the war. Joining us on the program, we have activist and political analyst and George Samueli, senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute from London Metropolitan University, joining us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. Sir, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II. What is your perspective on the recent developments with regards to the Ukraine conflict?
Well, I think that President Putin has made it very clear that he's not bluffing in this matter whatsoever, and that he intends to proceed with the integration of the ethnic Russian population of Ukraine into the Russian Federation, as that seems to be the only way to protect them from a war of genocide by the Ukrainian government.
George Samueli, Putin is accusing Western countries of engaging in nuclear blackmail and trying to destroy Russia. Can you explain what he means by that term, nuclear blackmail?
Well, I think that he means that the Western powers are essentially threatening Russia with nuclear war and thereby warning Russia away from continuing its ongoing military operations. But I think what he is really getting at here is that Russia will do whatever is necessary to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity. And as Mr. Bosnich pointed out, following the referendums and the inevitable incorporation of these territories within the Russian Federation, that means henceforth any attacks on those territories will be regarded as attacks on the Russian Federation. And Russia has now said that we will respond with all means at our disposal on any attack on our territorial integrity.
John Bosnich speaking at the United Nations Security Council. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were parties to the conflict, adding that, quote, the intentional fomenting of this conflict by the collective West remained unpunished. The question is, will this support that Western countries are giving Ukraine result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
Well, that's always a possibility because the NATO powers seem to have lost their heads. They don't realize the seriousness of this situation. Ukraine cannot be seen without reference to Russia. Ukraine, the current territory known as Ukraine, was in fact the first settlement area of the Russian nation. There was a country called Rus, which was headquartered and its capital was Kiev. And so the fact that this conflict is taking place around Kiev and around the original historic heartland of the Russian people is indicative of how central and how important this is to the current Russian government in Moscow. The Western powers, for some reason, seem to think that a line drawn on a map has created in Ukraine some kind of a Western-oriented NATO military colony. They are so wrong that it can't be put into words.
George Samueli in Budapest, speaking at the United Nations General Assembly, U.S. President Joe Biden strongly denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine, warning U.N. member states that, quote, if a nation can pursue imperial ambitions without consequences, then we put at risk everything this great institution stands for. It sounds like the kettle calling the pot black.
Yeah, it does indeed. And of course, what Biden said, and it's said repeated ad nauseum by the other NATO leaders, Emmanuel Macron, Liz Truss, Olaf Scholz, they will say the same thing, is that Russia, out of the blue, attacked Ukraine, unprovoked, unjustified aggression against the neighbor. This, of course, is completely untrue, because, of course, this conflict has been going on for a considerable amount of time, at least for 8 years, since essentially Ukraine launched a war against its own Russian-speaking population and failed to implement an agreement that was reached at Minsk, Minsk I agreement, Minsk II agreement, which was in fact incorporated within a UN Security Council resolution. So this was a UN Security Council resolution that supposedly the Western powers supported, but in fact did nothing whatever to coerce Kiev to attempt to implement. In fact, Kiev has admitted, or the former President Poroshenko admitted, that he was never had the slightest intention to implement Minsk. He was instead just buying time pretending to be interested in implementing agreement, but actually using the time to become stronger and stronger. And NATO willingly cooperated with this, pouring in arms for 8 years into Ukraine with a view, obviously, to mounting basically a genocidal campaign against the Russian-speaking population, meaning they would just simply had the plan to drive them out altogether. So, but of course, that disappears from the view of the Western leaders, who just simply go back to the story. Oh, Russia just one day woke up and decided to attack Ukraine. Nothing at all happened beforehand. So, what Biden says is the way Western media and Western politicians interpret what's going on. Completely untrue.
John Bosnich, the European Union is planning to impose new sanctions against Russia. The EU High Representative added Europe will continue to support Ukraine and provide it with military equipment as long as needed. Surely this will send ripple effects up and down the global market again. Tell us more about the ramifications of these measures and its repercussions for Europe, especially as winter approaches.
Well, I certainly wouldn't just call it ripple effects. I would call it a reverse tsunami. Yeah, exactly. Okay. What we've got here is every sanction that the Western powers, I prefer to call them just the American military colonies, in effect, every sanction they put on Russia is going to boomerang and hit them back twice as hard as it hits Russia. Russia has secured an export market for its primary export product, which is petroleum products, and the buyer is China. And China is not just a passive buyer. China is also a strong military power, which has an interest in maintaining the strength and integrity of Russia. So in every sanction that the Western military alliance puts on Russia, they are tightening the cooperation between Russia and China, and Russia and other countries such as Iran, which is attempting to pursue its own independent development. That's point one. Point number two. Under the current regime of sanctions, the energy crisis in Europe has reached such a stage that the European economies are going to collapse. When the European economies collapse, the people of Europe are going to look at their leaders and ask them, are you the leaders of our nations, or are you nothing more than American marionettes? If the public of Europe comes to the conclusion that their ruling class are all marionettes of a foreign power, we could see the collapse of the post-World War II U.S.-controlled European structures. And if that happens, this situation would not be a war, but it would be a tectonic shift of power in the entire world.
George Stanley, British Prime Minister Liz Truss has announced that in the following year, the UK will meet or exceed the amount of military aid spent on Ukraine in 2022. Is the UK in a position right now, in your opinion, to splash more money on military assistance to Ukraine rather than focus on its own economic troubles. Apart from that, interestingly, a British MP has said spending more on military aid to Ukraine will cut energy bills. How is that possible?
Well, of course, it isn't possible. And as you say, the UK does not have this kind of money. And the only way it can do so is if it starts printing money. But given that inflation in the UK is already on course to be around 20% by January, there is just simply no way that the UK can come up with this sort of money. But the issue, however, is a more serious one than that, because if the UK does indeed throw in this heavy military hardware into Ukraine, and this hardware is going to be used on Russian people, which is what's going to happen if Ukraine is going to continue with its war, then, of course, UK is explicitly a party to this war, and therefore the consequences could be quite serious for the UK. But almost certainly, Russia will respond by cutting off all energy exports to Europe altogether. I mean, it's not just going to be, well, it'll be 20% or 30% or whatever, it's going to be 0%. And when that happens, then I think the European economies will just come tumbling down. I mean, German economy is already, and that's the powerhouse of Europe, is already in a very precarious position. And once it's completely cut off, I think there's just going to be a complete collapse within Europe. And then we'll see what the political consequences will be, because this is an entirely unnecessary war. In the first place, and it was entirely unnecessary for the European powers to get themselves into a war that had nothing to do with them and did not in any way threaten their security. So they've got themselves into this absolute catastrophe for no intelligible reason whatsoever. And I would indeed expect that there will be enormous political ramifications.
Mr. Bozich, let's put some focus on events on the ground. Ukraine claims to have reclaimed major swaths of territory with its counteroffensives, forcing Russian troops to retreat. I want to get your thoughts on that. Do you think it's due to the assistance that it's getting from the U.S. and its allies? And is this just what the U.S. and the NATO wants, this conflict to be a prolonged one, to see it dragged out for as long as possible in the hopes that it weakens Russia?
When the military historians look back on this conflict, they are going to praise the Russian generals and the Russian general staff for the brilliant way in which they pursued the battle. The recent gains, so-called gains by the Ukrainian army, especially in the northeastern region around Kharkov, have been taken at the expense of several hundred Russian soldiers and the loss of more than 4,700 Ukrainian soldiers. We're talking a death count up to 20 times higher on the Ukrainian side. And what they've achieved is they've inherited an area of empty ground with no resources and nothing of any value. What has happened here is Russia has arranged a strategic withdrawal, which drew in a Ukrainian army, their best reserves, put them on an open plain, and allowed them to be destroyed from the air. Now, this is what Russia could have done to the city of Kiev at the beginning of the war and chose not to do in the interests of finding a negotiated solution. Now that Kiev has made it clear, and the NATO colonies, NATO military colonies in the EU, have backed it up, it looks like time for real war. Real war means that Russia is going to withdraw its strategic reserves from other areas and put them into the battle. Now, Russia is a country of 145 million people. It can easily put another 300,000 men in the field, and these are not green recruits. These are people who have already gone through military training and have served in the Russian military. Ukraine has no such recruits available. It will be a walkover if it becomes a full-scale war. And if it's a walkover, this is not just the defeat of Ukraine, but the defeat of NATO. And we can see the very, very high possibility that NATO itself will fracture and will lose member countries, starting with Romania and Hungary.
George Samuel, your referendums on joining Russia are due to take place from today until Tuesday in several largely Russian-held regions in the east and in the south of Ukraine, which, as a matter of fact, comprise around 15% of the country's territory. Ukraine and its allies have said that such votes would be illegal. The UN chief also has expressed concerns over the referendums. What is your take on the issue of these referendums being held?
Well, we can be pretty sure that the referendum will be overwhelmingly in favor of joining the Russian Federation. We also know that the constitutional process of incorporating these territories within the Russian Federation will be accomplished very quickly. If you remember how it was with Crimea in 2014, it was done very quickly. So the State Duma will pass the appropriate legislation, and then President Putin will sign it, and these territories will be a part of Russia. And of course, it now means that Ukraine will be targeting, if it continues the war, and it says it intends to continue the war, the NATO powers, all of them have said, yeah, nothing changes. We don't care about any referendum. We're going to continue doing everything that we've been doing. Well, that means that they are ready to escalate to a full-scale war with Russia. And, of course, Russia, you know, can easily insert this 300,000 reserves and more. It's a big country. The casualties that Russia has sustained so far are vastly dwarfed by the casualties sustained by Ukraine, which is, you know, about a third, you know, maybe even about a quarter of Russia's size. So as Russia escalates, Ukraine has no means of escalating because it's already sustained casualties. Now, the Russians have estimated that Ukrainians have lost about 60,000 killed in action. That may be true or may not be true. We don't know for sure, but most estimates are in that ballpark. So Ukraine doesn't have any additional manpower that it can draw upon other than if NATO were to get directly involved themselves. Well, you know, this is the time for, you know, NATO to put up or shut up. I mean, having said all this time, well, we're not directly involved in this war. We're not party to it. Well, you know, Kyiv is going to turn to them and say, okay, are you ready to get directly involved? I suspect that they're not, in which case they will have no choice but to tell Kyiv it's time to knock it up. Now, it's possible that they're so stupid and they're so crazy that they will get involved directly. Unfortunately, for NATO, they're not really in any position in that part of Europe to wage any kind of a war against Russia. It's a hell of a big undertaking for them to get kind of manpower into Ukraine.
John Bosnich, final question to you. In retrospect, could the U.S. and NATO, could have acted differently to de-escalate the situation altogether? Russia put forth its requests, Ukraine can't join NATO, no more eastward expansion of the military alliance. What do you think?
Well, in fact, they can't do that because the sole purpose of NATO is to drive to the east, or as Hitler and the Kaisers before him called it, Drang nach Osten. It's a perpetual desire of the Central European powers grouped around the former Austro-Hungarian Empire and Imperial Germany. This is the fundamental reason for NATO. And when I look at the data here, it's not that NATO has become involved in this war. NATO is this war. Zelensky is NATO's puppet. Ukraine is a victim of NATO's foreign policy. And when I look at the list of what charges can be laid against the NATO leadership, I don't even know where one would start. Torture, ethnic cleansing, genocide, Nazi revanchism, the creation and violation of media rights, and the fundamental violation of the human rights of not only the ethnic Russian citizens of Ukraine, but the ethnic Ukrainian citizens of Ukraine who've been tricked and cheated into a war that should have never taken place. Where the prosecution will begin, I don't know. But where it will end, I do know. In Kiev.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, journalists, activists, and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade, and also senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. Thank you for contributing to the show. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Back to Reality, and thank you for joining us. So, I am Asma, your humble host. I am a student of English literature. And in here, I have with me two very dear guests, Zainab and Bita. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's a really big pleasure for me to join you for this discussion. I am Bita, a medical student from Iran.
And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm Zainab Sadat. I'm from Iran and I have my MA in TFL, teaching English as a foreign language. And it's my pleasure to be here today in this discussion.
Thank you very much, both of you. Thank you for joining us in today's episode. So there are many conditions in life in which I think that there's no way for me to cure from the breakage that I've got into my heart. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I'm sure that it has happened to both of you as well and to the audience, of course.
Definitely.
There are many times that we feel that we're overcome and it's Finnish.
That's enough.
Yeah, that's enough. And I cannot do anything for it. There's no way for me to cure the wounds that I have in my soul. And most of the time, I unfortunately have to confess that it seems like it's a right notion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want you to tell me that, do you believe in this notion that says that there is no cure for the wounds that you've got from your past?
It's not true. I do not agree, as always, I
think. Yes.
And the thing is, one thing that connects human beings together is the ability to feel pains.
Yeah.
We feel pain. And when you feel pain or sorrow or something, you will understand the other people that exactly feel the same way as you.
Yeah.
And this will make sympathy, empathy, anything this life that is needed for human beings. And the thing is, you're telling me that there is no cure for your wounds you have in the past. And this is not true, because we have a blessing from God that is forgetting.
Yeah. After, some people are very difficult at forgetting.
I know. I'm not telling you that it's not difficult. I'm telling you that we have this blessing. And one of the absolute cure for this problem is just letting it go and send it somewhere during your daily life. And when time goes, when time, you know, passes,
you will see the magic of time.
Exactly. This is the magic of time, that you will understand it. Okay, this is not that much important anymore to me.
Yeah.
Because I have many other problems.
So, Zainab, are you a good person in letting go?
You know, me personally, I did not experience a really, really difficult situation in my life yet. Some situation that would leave a wound in me.
So good for
but
you.
But I know
there were different situations. Life.
But the most difficult one, you know, again, one of my relatives, she lost her father when she was... Her father accompanied by two or three of her uncles car accident when she was a little girl. And then since she was the only child of her family, she kept on her life with her mother. And then she got married with a man who she loved, and they lived happily
ever after.
And that was when, that was when, after some years, her husband was diagnosed with a disease. And the husband went to hospital and he went through a surgery, and that was successful. But suddenly he faced a heart attack and he died.
Wow.
And that was in that interval when her mother was diagnosed with cancer.
God.
And she lost her mother too. And the interval between her husband's
death... Is she alive
right
now?
Yes, you see. The interval between her husband's death and her mother's death was just... 1 month at tops.
Oh.
And, you know, all of us felt so sorrow and we were so sad. But as you said, the magic of time, you know, after 2 years, I think the incidents, they happened 2 years ago. And now I can see that she could handle that. And that's just a miracle. She has married another man. Interesting.
I want to tell you, this is not a miracle, first of all. She was really strong, you know, to overcome these all misery. And I think if I were, for example, in her place, I wouldn't overcome all of these miseries in my life.
Yeah.
The thing is, I think there are many tips that she used in this difficult role to overcome all of this. First of all, the thing is, she once experienced this difficult situation when she was a child, as you told me. And this shows us that after that situation, she used, many correct methods to overcome that. That after a while, that she faced the situation again and again and again. Even at that time, she was again successful. And I think the thing is, she was really strong to control her mind. You have to try to control your mind in different situations. You cannot control life, but you can control your mind.
Trust me, sometimes you even cannot control your mind.
You know, I do agree with that point. But the thing is, sometimes you have to do it. There is no other way.
Just, it depends on the idea just you mentioned, the strength, you know? Not
exactly.
All people are the same.
And the will to leave, I think.
Yeah,
you know, there are most of people that doesn't have any goal or something in their lives. They're like, okay... There is nothing more I can do with this life. I want to die. I have nothing more.
Yeah, they already are depressed.
But I think